Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Betsy Fisher Martin, senior executive producer of NBC's Meet the Press and managing editor for NBC News Political Programming. She'll speak on the topic, Meeting the Press, Headlines in History from the Longest-Running Television Program. Mrs. Martin's remarks were given as the annual Alpha Sigma Nu lecture. Alpha Sigma Nu, the prestigious Jesuit Honor Society, was organized at Marquette University in 1915. The Creighton University student chapter, established on December 8, 1921, was the first to affiliate with the charter group. Today's lecture is the 54th since 1955, sponsored by the Alpha Sigma Nu Alumni Club, and is the 13th lecture designated as the William F. Kelly S.J. Endowed Lecture. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 16, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Thomas Cavill, the president of the Alpha Sigma Nu Alumni Board.
Betsy Fisher Martin is one of the country's top TV news producers, and has spent more than half of her life producing Meet the Press at NBC News. She has worked closely with Tim Russert and was Tom Brokaw's producer for the 2008 presidential election. Betsy has been honored with several awards for her work with NBC, including two news and documentary Emmys and the Walter Cronkite Award for Excellence in Political Journalism, to name just two. She had worked every job at Meet the Press on her way to becoming executive producer of the show in 2002. Just recently, Betsy was given another promotion and now serves as senior executive producer of Meet the Press, as well as becoming the managing editor of NBC's news political programming. Betsy was the anchor that helped Meet the Press through the tragic loss of Tim Russert. Through her leadership and experience, Meet the Press continues its long-held position as a top Sunday morning TV program. I don't know about you, but I've never met an Emmy Award winner before, so I'm pleased to give you Betsy Fisher Martin.
Thank you, Dr. Cavill, honorary father today. Thank you. That was very nice. And thank you, Father Shanahan and Father Landon, for having me here today. It's an honor to be here and speak with you. And it's an honor to be here with my colleague, Erin Fogarty. We had a lot of years in the trenches of television news together, and she was a wonderful colleague and even more wonderful friend. So I'm happy to have a good reason to come here to Omaha to catch up with her. I spend most of my week thinking of questions for the show, so I am anxious to get to yours. But first, as we say on Sunday mornings, I want to talk to you first about some histories and headlines behind Meet the Press and the history of the program, why Sunday mornings are a special place in our political dialogue, and what I see as our mission each week for the program. And this being an esteemed honor society of a Jesuit institution, I want to talk to you a bit about some lessons I learned during the 17 years that I had the honor to work with a good Jesuit boy by the name of Tim Russert. He used to say that between working with him for so long and being raised in the city of New Orleans, I was an honorary Catholic, so I will do my best here with you this afternoon. I want to give you a little bit about the history of the program. It is the longest-running television program in the world. November 1947 was the first television broadcast of the show, if you can believe. And it started actually as a radio program in 1945 on Mutual Broadcasting. The co-creators of the program were two people, Lawrence Spivak, who at the time was an editor and publisher of a magazine called American Mercury. And part of the concept for a radio show at the point was to try to get subscriptions to the magazine. They thought if we could advertise and we could promote on the radio, we can get more people to subscribe to the magazine. And there was a woman he teamed up with, and this, you know, rare in the age of women in television and radio. Her name was Martha Roundtree. And she had a radio show at the time called Leave It to the Girls, sort of a 1945 version of The View. And they teamed up together, and her original pitch, when they went in to pitch the executives on Mutual Radio, she said, well, wouldn't it be great, she said to the executives, if we could get people like Stalin and Roosevelt and Churchill to answer questions from the press. And the executives loved that concept. And after the pitch meeting, Lawrence Spivak said to her, oh my gosh, do you think we can really get these people? And she said, I said, like Churchill, Stalin, Roosevelt. So a good TV producer from the beginning. She was a pioneer in the news business that was often dominated by men. Sheryl Sandberg would be very proud of all the leaning in she did. She was once described in the press as a diesel engine under a lace handkerchief. So you can sort of imagine a little bit about her. But anyway, the program was on television for 2 years, and then this new medium came into being, television. And they decided to take the show on television. Now, we think of Meet the Press now as a Sunday morning show, but at the time, it actually aired on Thursday nights, prime time, as they say. And that lasted until about 1965, when the whole being of Sunday morning television came in. And it was a novel concept at the very beginning, Meet the Press was. It was pitched, you know, and again, to having newsmakers, but having a press conference of the air, where you could have journalists asking newsmakers questions. It was a novel approach back then. And here we are, 3,400 shows later, and going strong and interviewing newsmakers, driving the agenda. I do have a little DVD, what we like to call a sizzle reel, that will show you a little bit about our history and give you some perspective. And a lot of these faces you'll see will be familiar to you, but give you a sense of the work that the show has done over the past 65 years. And then I'll come back up and talk a little bit more.
From NBC News in Washington, this is Meet the Press with David Gregory.
There are very few things in life that are permanent, particularly in television, but Meet the Press has been a constant. The longest-running program in television history.
I'm one of those persons that doesn't believe that a political party ought to just be a rallying ground for anybody that wants to get under the tent. I'm of the opinion that a political party ought to stand for something.
We may have to use lumberjack tactics, bare-knuckle tactics. If those are the only kind of tactics the communists understand, then those are the tactics we'll use.
Do you think we shall ever have a woman president?
Yes, of course we will.
People all across the country can take some time each Sunday morning, sit down with their families, have a cup of coffee, and learn quite a bit about their leaders and their government.
We have a situation now with Cuba where Mr. Khrushchev is threatening if we take any action. We don't know exactly what action would bring about this rain of rockets.
Mr. Nixon has a Dixie speech and he has a Northern speech. I have made the same speech in all the places that I have been.
I'm a quite candid man. I'm quite direct. Perhaps too direct.
But honesty and candor has been restored in government.
Neither I nor the American people would support the sending of an American team to Moscow with Soviet invasion troops in Afghanistan.
I don't have an ideology. I think ideology is a scare word.
I do not approve of arms for hostages.
I don't think there's ever been a president of either party and in a philosophy that didn't think that he should have gotten a better press.
A war of choice or a war of necessity. It's a war of necessity.
We have an obligation in Washington as leaders to make sure that we are sending a strong message, that we can disagree without being disagreeable.
Part of understanding what's going on here at home means understanding what's going on globally. Dictators, prime ministers, and kings, Meet the Press is a real window on the world.
I am not communist. I do not agree with communism.
We do not recognize the communist regime on the mainland. We consider them bandits.
A strong Israel is not only the best guarantee for peace, but is the best incentive for peace.
My aim and the aim of my organization and the aim of my people is to establish our democratic Palestinian states, where Jews, Christians, and Muslims can live in equality and friendship.
As far as we are concerned, we are not the toys of any country, including the United States.
If peace is achieved, if there is progress towards it, in my lifetime, it will be the crowning achievement of my life.
The attack on America was an attack on us too, because we stand for the same things.
Civilian casualties are undermining support in the Afghan people for the war on terrorism and for the relations with America. How can you expect a people who keep losing their children to remain friendly?
Debates, investigations, partisanship. Politics is a pretty tough game with some tough players, and they aren't shy about making their positions known.
I wonder whether or not you would enjoy being investigated for the pure sense of power to investigate.
There's going to be a war.
A war between whom?
Between the friends of the president and the independent counsel. That's exactly who it's between.
It's inconceivable to me that this president would deliberately refuse to negotiate and deliberately prefer to just have the whole system break down.
The administration said nuclear weapons tie in al-Qaeda. That's the distortion. That's the misrepresentation. That's the lie.
That's the biggest ripoff. I mean, that is against the law to buy a vote.
The bread and butter of Meet the Press is politics, of course, but we're also here to talk about social change, religion, and the welfare of individuals around the globe.
We have a great deal of church going in America, but we're not relating this church going to our personal daily lives.
I do feel that if we are to be truly Americans and citizens of this nation, then we must not have any barriers standing before us on the basis of race.
And you can't do anything about a family life if men don't have jobs, if schools, children don't have good schools, if people live in ghettos.
What kind of choice is it, after all, to be able to go out and earn half as much as a man for doing the very same work?
When your parents are there every day, they have a much more influence on that kid than what we do.
There's a tsunami happening every month in Africa, but it's an avoidable catastrophe.
Health brings the population growth down, which is counterintuitive. It sets a country up, whether it's to educate their people or sustain the environment in a very positive way.
Meet the Press has a unique role in American society, a vital role in democracy, wartime, peacetime, and times of national uncertainty.
Not attacked in Korea, but we were pledged to the establishment of a free and independent Korea. And we responded, and the whole American people was for it.
This war can be ended. And it should be ended now.
Everything that I did during the war was to try to bring it to a close.
It's never been the American policy to go after a single individual or try to kill anyone.
We thought it was an accident, a strange accident. And then on the drive to Capitol Hill, we heard about the second plane. So then we knew, of course, it was a terrorist attack.
And I remember stopping. I didn't have a lot of time to stop and think. I just remember just saying to myself, this is something much worse than we've ever experienced before.
I don't think it's likely to unfold that way, Tim, because I really do believe we will be greeted as liberators.
The war in Afghanistan, unfortunately, was lost in the fog of the war in Iraq.
I believe I've got to be aggressive, but I also have to be civil and foster a sense of constructive engagement. If I can always remember that, I will have fulfilled my role of moderator. The proud tradition of Martha Roundtree, Larry Spivak, and Tim Russell. More than six decades of Meet the Press.
Martha Roundtree, moderator of Meet the Press.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another session of Meet the Press.
This is Ned Brooks inviting you to Meet the Press.
I'm Lawrence Spivak, and this is Meet the Press.
This is Bill Monroe inviting you to Meet the Press.
Good day, I am Marvin Kell.
I'm Roger Mudd.
And that's Meet the Press for this Sunday. I'm Chris Wallace.
I'm Garrick Utley. I hope you'll join us again next week for Sunday Today and Meet the Press.
I'm Tim Russert. That's all for today.
I'm David Gregory. We'll be back next week.
If it's Sunday, it's Meet the Press.
A lot of-
of times people ask me, what does an executive producer of the program really do? And unlike the movies, I do not fund the show. I'm not putting up my money. Basically, the man you see right there, David Greger, if anything goes right, it's to his credit, and if anything goes wrong, it's my fault. That is the short version of what I do every week. I try to make sure things don't go wrong. And I try to kind of do that sausage making every week in terms of thinking of who we're going to have on the show, what subjects we're going to talk about, how we're going to do the questions, and I work with the moderator very closely on making all of that happen on a Sunday morning. A lot of that goes into the guest booking. That's the driver of the program, is the big newsmaker guest interview. And it's sometimes a very hard-fought battle. We have four other shows competing against us for guests each week. And what I try to do is think ahead. So I want to do a show on a Sunday that is not just a rehash of news that you've seen during the week. It is not This Week in Review. I want to take a story and figure out, how do we move it forward? How do we get to the bottom of something? How do we progress a story? So that is something that I'm always conscious of, is when I'm putting the show together and thinking about who we're going to have on. Now, there comes a time, too, during the week that you have to do a little bit of a juggling act. Something that you may think on a Monday or Tuesday in this 24/7 news cycle may by the next Sunday not be relevant at all. But it could be, and you have these other shows going after this very small pool of people. You don't want to ask someone to the prom and then decide that you're going to go with the cuter guy on a Friday, the day before. So you have to be very respectful of that. So a lot of the show, a lot of thinking during the week that goes on with our staff is trying to juggle those balls and figure out, well, who is available, what is the story going to look like, and then do we go ahead and make a commitment to a guest or not? Now, we do have to sometimes cancel a guest if there's breaking news that happens. There's been a couple of crazy Saturdays that go on. Most recently, the Saturday that Gabby Giffords was shot, that was a Saturday afternoon, and that was, you know, scrub the show, whatever we had planned for the next day, and start over. And so rebooking an entire show, doing an entire week's worth of work in 24 hours. There was a famous Sunday morning that Aaron and I were in the trenches together. The morning Saddam Hussein was captured was at 6 a.m. on a Sunday morning. And I remember driving to work and hearing that on the radio and then realizing, okay, in 3 hours, we taped the show at 9 o'clock, we're going to have a whole new show. And Aaron and I calling senators up, getting people to come in, waking up senators. Aaron had a great phone list of senators' home numbers, and calling them and, good morning, Senator, have you heard the news? Can you make your way to the studio? We've had instances where we've gotten in booking battles with the other shows. One time during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, we had a big interview with Bob Bennett, who is the lawyer for President Clinton, and we had gotten an exclusive with him for that Sunday, and we got tipped off that that morning our friends and competitors from ABC were going to send Sam Donaldson to Bob Bennett's home to catch him on his way out of the house and do an ambush sidewalk interview with Bob Bennett so that they would have the first interview with him. So we fortunately got tipped off. We sent a satellite truck and another correspondent. We had like a battle on the sidewalk for Bob Bennett. Finally, he made his way to our car. We ended up having the exclusive, but it was a little bit, it's not quite as bad as you hear the morning, the Today Show GMA wars, but we have our tussles on a Sunday morning. I did learn under the master of Tim Russert, who was a great booker in himself. He, before, not many people realize this, but before he was the moderator of Meet the Press, he came to NBC from politics, which you probably do know, but he came to NBC as an executive in New York. He was hired to be the president of NBC News' number two, and his job was to reinvigorate the Today Show at the time, with Brian Gumbel and Jane Pauley, and be the executive in charge of that program. So Tim, and you'll appreciate this, decided, well, what a better person to book for Easter week with the Today Show but the Pope. So, this was 1985. He decides to write a letter in Polish to try to book the Pope on the Today Show for Jane Pauley and Brian Gumbel. He also did a masterstroke of horse trading. He decided to go to Philadelphia, where he met with Cardinal Kroll to lobby him to convince the Pope to do an interview with the Today Show. Well, the Cardinal spent the morning with Tim and then invited Tim next door to hear the choir practicing. And between hymns, Tim turned to the Cardinal and very reverently said, "What a beautiful sound. Wouldn't it be great if the choir could sing at the Vatican?" And the Cardinal said, "Well, that's always been my dream." Well, the next thing you know, the Today Show plane is leaving from New York with 30 choir members on board to go sing at the Vatican. So he managed to get the Pope, and the Cardinal got his choir, and the rest is history, as they say. The only television interview that the Pope really ever did, that first one there with the Today Show, and that sort of, you know, made Tim in the eyes of NBC News. He can book the Pope, he can book anybody. So that's a hard person to be able to work with and live up to. Sometimes we do have the occasion of the big get that we get that goes away. I remember in particular, one Saturday night, we had a big interview. This was shortly after 9/11, a big interview with the ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Prince Bandar. And we had promoted the interview. He's our main guest. We had promoted the interview all week, an exclusive interview with Prince Bandar. And then my phone rings at Saturday at 2 a.m., which is never a good sign. And it was the embassy calling to say, "We're very sorry, but Prince Bandar is not going to be able to come on tomorrow. In a couple hours." And I was, I can't believe this. What are you going to do? I tried to convince them. There was no convincing. I said, "Well, you have to give me somebody." They said, "Okay, well, we will give you someone from the embassy, Adel Al-Joubert, who I knew at the time, and he was the foreign policy advisor to the Crown Prince." So I remember waking up Tim at 4 in the morning to tell him this news, and he was not happy. And he insisted on keeping the taped open of the program the same. So you turned on your television at 9 a.m., there was a taped open of the show with Tim's voice that said, "Our issues this Sunday morning, an exclusive interview with Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, blah, blah, blah." And then up comes Tim live. But first, late last night, a member of the embassy has called to say that Prince Bandar will not be keeping his commitment to appear on Meet the Press. Here in his place is Adel Al-Joubert, the foreign policy advisor to the Crown Prince. Good morning, Mr. Adel Al-Joubert. Where is the prince? Is it true that the prince has a history of erratic behavior? Is it true that the prince is on medication? Sort of went downhill from there. But all is well that ends well. Poor Adel Al-Joubert is now actually the ambassador to Saudi Arabia. So he survived that inquisition. We do have, I mentioned, a lot of juggling that goes on with guests. Back, not to overly refer to the Monica Lewinsky scandal, but it gave us a lot of characters in a lot of different ways. And one of them was the notion of somebody doing all 5 Sunday morning television shows in one sitting in the morning. That had never been done before. Nowadays, it's a little more common. In fact, just last weekend, we had Marco Rubio, Senator Rubio, on the show, and he managed to tape, actually now 7, because he did Telemundo and Univision on a Sunday morning. But when this first came into being during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, William Ginsburg was her attorney. And after that scandal broke, he was the first person to ever do all 5 Sunday morning shows. He literally went from the car to each studio, and we were able to pre-tape some of them from studio to studio doing the interviews. And within our Sunday morning cadre of producers, we now call that doing the full Ginsburg, a sort of folklore that one more great thing we have from the Monica Lewinsky scandal. Another full Ginsburg that someone did one time that actually didn't turn out that well was Colin Powell. One morning, this was a big interview that we had with him when he was Secretary of State. He decided to do all five shows. He was overseas in Jordan that morning, and we actually pre-taped the interview. I think it was 2 a.m. We came in to do this interview, and we had each been allotted 10 minutes with the secretary. Well, and this was the height of the war. There was a lot going on. Clearly 10 minutes in Tim's mind was not going to suffice. So at like minute 11 or 12, Tim said to the secretary, "Well, finally, Mr. Secretary, let me ask you." And all of a sudden, the camera that was trained on the secretary outside in Jordan panned over to a group of palm trees. And you could see this look on Tim's face, like as he was looking at the monitor, what's going on? And I was in the control room on the phone with our people on the ground, and they said, Emily Miller, who was the press person for the secretary, has moved the camera. Like, she was upset that we went over our 10 minutes, and she physically moved the camera out of the way, which had obviously never been done before. And so I told him very quickly in his ear, you know, Emily Miller moved the camera, and he says to the secretary, "Mr. Secretary, I understand a member of your staff has moved the camera. That's highly inappropriate." And Colin Powell is, Emily, move the camera back. Get out of the way. And so the camera pans back over from the palm trees onto the secretary, and Colin Powell says, "Go ahead, Tim. Sorry about that. Ask your final question." And he did. And so we ended up actually running that entire interview as is, because we had different wire services calling in to listen to the program. So after that was on the air, as you can imagine, I even got phone calls from Inside Edition that morning asking what had happened. But Colin Powell was a good sport about it. He came back to the program a few months later, and I ordered one of those blow-up palm trees off of the internet. We presented it to him as the first annual Meet the Press Palm Tree Award, and all's well. That ends well with that. But he was a good sport for sure. We've had some other big interviews that I'm very proud of over the years. Colin Powell did another really big interview with us when he decided to endorse Obama for president on Meet the Press. Tom Brokaw was the moderator of the program at that time, and that set sort of an all-time viewer record, in addition to the Sunday that we had Vice President Cheney on 6 days after 9/11 from Camp David. Aaron was there for that. I actually booked part of that show and worked on that show. I was in the hospital on bed rest about to have my daughter, who was actually born on that day. And so I missed out going to Camp David, but Aaron had it all covered. And we got it on the air. And that was our high watermark in terms of viewers on the program. And we also had a big interview with President Bush, his first interview to do his reelection campaign in 2004 in the Oval Office. And just recently, in January, we did an interview with President Obama, also from the White House, which was very exciting to be there and work on that. So it's been a lot of fun, and I have, you know, a lot of credit to give to my mentor, Tim. Incredibly, we're coming up on the five-year mark. It's sort of hard to believe, in June, where we lost Tim. And, you know, much has been written and said about his incredible journalistic talents, much of which you saw in those clips. And it's a tribute to his hard work and preparation and skilled questioning that really catapulted Meet the Press to the top Sunday morning television program. I just wanted to share a little bit about the man behind the interview desk that you don't always get to see. Father mentioned a little bit about his personality and his principles. He, for 17 years, quizzed all the leading political figures and enlightened audiences and really informed the American public. His fascination was politics, and it was contagious. He really made him one of the most trusted names in television. He changed TV by techniques by, for instance, using graphics on the program and holding politicians accountable. A lot of times when I first started Meet the Press, I was the researcher, and we would come up with great background quotes about various senators. You know, "Senator, you said this 4 years ago, and now you're saying this. You know, why did you change your position?" And usually the senator would say, "Well, I never said that, Tim." And Tim would say, "Well, yes, you did. No, you didn't." This was good back and forth, back and forth. And so finally we came up with the concept, well, let's put it on a graphic and put it on the screen for everybody to see. And that's a technique that Tim really was able to perfect and something that you see a lot now. Another point that he really brought to it, and a lot of this was his legal training, was the ability to ask those really tough questions. He used to say, if you can't answer tough questions, you can't make tough decisions. And he was a believer in that, and that was his motto and really defined his doggedness when trying to hold politicians accountable. A few times we had politicians who were upset about a line of questioning, and they threatened never to return, but they always did. That's the thing about television news. It's sometimes the politicians need the news media as much as we need them, and they can sort of get over past interviews and come back. He never did really hit below the belt, except he would tell you that one time he did. This is actually when I first started at the program. I was an intern. It was 1991. And we had a debate. I'm from New Orleans, and we had a debate with the two men who were running for governor at the time, Edwin Edwards, who you might recall, and David Duke, who you might recall in his past. And he, Tim later admits that he crossed the line with Duke. He actually asked him during the interview, what is it about the United States that made you become a Nazi? And later, he would call his dad after the show, and his dad said, well, yeah, that might have gone a little too far, but if you're going to make a mistake in your career, you might as well make it with a Nazi, and that's okay. But, you know, one of the things that Tim was able to do is to really get to the heart of the question. And I remember specifically during that interview as well, David Duke kept saying, I don't want to talk about my past. I want to talk about the future of Louisiana. And Tim, just on cue, said, okay, you want to talk about the future of Louisiana? What are the three biggest employers in the state? No clue. So that sort of, and that was not a gotcha question. That was just Tim off the cuff saying, okay, that's what you want to talk about? Tell me the three biggest employers. And he didn't know. And, the election was history after that. Tim's also had this huge passion for politics, and it really drew people to him. He could make even the most casual observer of politics feel a sense of excitement about a campaign or a new poll or even a campaign finance report. This actually is what drew me into a career in journalism. I had studied politics as an undergrad and had never taken a communications course. I had done a number of different internships. I had been on the Hill. I thought I was going to go to law school and maybe be involved in politics. I had applied to go to law school, and then I got an internship at Meet the Press. It was our bureau, our NBC Washington bureau, I went to American University, and our bureau was literally down the street from my school. So I figured, I was a senior, I said, this is great, I can sleep late, I can walk to work, this is an ideal internship. And little did I know, I would just sort of got bit by that journalism bug from Tim. His enthusiasm really drew me in, and I realized that while I love politics, I was not a very political person. I love the debate about politics, and so it ended up being the perfect fit for me so that I could use my love of politics in a constructive way. And Tulane University still has my $700 deposit, and I don't have any law school student loans, so it all worked out. His enthusiasm, as you might recall, was on vivid display in the 2000 election. Who can forget Florida, Florida, Florida? And that was the essence of Tim. I mean, he wanted something very basic. I remember being in meetings with him and all the various producers on election night and whiz-bang graphics that they wanted to do with the Electoral College, and Tim said, just give me a whiteboard. Go to Staples. I just want a board. I just want a marker, and I'm going to keep track of everything. And so, literally, I was sitting at, you know, his feet on the anchor desk, scribbling numbers on the whiteboard, handing him his new whiteboard. He would hold things up, scratch out numbers on our calculator, and, you know, Florida, Florida, Florida just unfolded. But to him, politics did not have to be overcomplicated. It was very simple, and he could make it simple. There was a lot of times, too, when we have people on the program, and we still try to stay true to this, is that we don't want to get too in the weeds. He didn't like people to come on and talk Washington speak and do a lot of acronyms. He would always correct people when he did that and make politics enjoyable to watch, and it was sort of the horse race. He was like a kid in the candy store on that. I remember as he used to say, and I would hate this when he would say it, he'd say, the secret to Meet the Press is simple. You get the top guest, you ask them the tough questions, and then you just turn on the lights. I would be like, turn on the lights? It's not that easy. I have to produce this thing. There's more to it than that. But there was nothing simple about getting a live broadcast on the air each Sunday. But he was always so focused on the interview, he did not always appreciate all of the things that could go on or wrong about him. But he did understand that communicating the facts and informing the public could be done smartly without talking over the heads of people. He was a firm believer that Americans were starved for a substantive conversation, and his goal each week was to present just that, and that's what we try to do every week, but we do turn on the lights and we do a little bit more than that. He also had a great sense about the questions and his sense of family. He always said his dad, Big Russ, was the chiefest and most effective focus group he could have. After the show on Sunday, he would go to his office and call Big Russ and ask him what he thought about the interviews and you know, whether the politicians were being truthful, and Big Russ would always be able to get to right to the bottom on whether somebody was trying to dodge a question or pull one over on the viewers. He had a sense of fighting for the underdog. He didn't have any tolerance for a sense of entitlement or the gamesmanship or elitism, or whining, hated whining. He had a big sign on the front of his desk that said, "Thou shall not whine." Literally sat there. So anybody that would come in his office would know not to whine. I felt like I should bring that home and throw it to my daughter on occasion. See what she thinks of that. He was also the Washington bureau chief, and so there were a lot of people that worked for him, and he really expected hard work from those people. By 9 in the morning, he had read 5 or 6 newspapers. He was ready to go on the day. You know, his first phone call to me in the morning would be, "What do you know? What do you know?" And do the download. And he did his homework, and he was always, always prepared. He never showed up for an interview with being unprepared, and he really believed that mastering both sides of the argument was the surest way to guarantee impartiality. He was often called it being an equal opportunity questioner. A lot of times people ask me, well, how would in this business, what do you think about programs that are slanted to one side or the other, an opinion? And we see a lot of that on cable news. But I think it's important for Meet the Press to really to be that place that is nonpartisan, that can go down the middle, and that can be the equal opportunity questioner, that can ask tough questions to Democrats, tough questions to Republicans. I always say we don't have a dog in the fight. Lauren Spivak used to say, learn as much as you can about the guest and take the other side. That was advice that he gave to Tim when he first started, and that's really what we try to do each week with the program. Sometimes people ask me the difference. Our moderator now is David Gregory, who covered the Bush White House for 8 years and is very experienced in Washington and politics. And you know, a lot of what I've tried to do with the show is figure out how to evolve it from one person to another. Obviously, huge shoes for, you know, someone to fill from Tim. But I think what David can bring is his own part to the show, which is David has a background of journalism that Tim didn't have. So what I think David can bring is that natural sense of journalistic curiosity. And so what I try to do with the program is figure out how do we produce the program more toward David as opposed toward the Tim element, with keeping the mission of the program the same. And try to evolve the show in terms of the look of the show. We have a new set. We have new graphics. Now, if you watch the show today and then you watched a tape of the show 7 years ago, it would be dramatically different, but we did it very gradual. It was not an overnight change. Had the pleasure of speaking to a group of students today, and someone said, "Well, why don't you just do the Jon Stewart show on Sunday morning?" I said, "Well, we also have a very loyal base of people that have been watching the show for years, and so we don't want to really upset that apple cart, but there are things that we do, and I would love to have younger viewers of the program that we try to do to keep the show up to speed. You know, sometimes we'll pay clips from Saturday Night Live. We do a lot of engagement on social media and Twitter and Facebook. We do have the show available online. We have the show available on podcasts. I remember another Tim story. We first had a podcast when Tim was the moderator, and this was all very, very new to him. He was not technical at all. And I remember saying, Tim, we're going to have a podcast to Meet the Press. Podcast? What's a podcast? I said, well, we're going to promote it this week. Just read the teleprompter. And so at the end of the show, he said, be sure to download our Meet the Press podcast. And he sort of forgot about it. And then being very competitive, the next day he said, how did the podcast do? How did it do? I said, well, actually, we did great. We were like the number 3 or 4 podcast. And he said, what was number 1 and number 2? And I said, well, it was actually porn. And so he would say, from then on, this is, the iPod was very new at the time. And whenever he would see a little old lady doing her gardening, listening to her iPod, he would think, I wonder what she is listening to. Someone asked me the other day, I was speaking to somebody, and they said, would Tim be on Twitter? And I said, Tim would be a lurker on Twitter. He would not tweet, but he would love to see what everybody else was saying about him, about the show, about politics. He would be the ultimate lurker. He'd have some secret code name that nobody would know, and he would sit there and enjoy seeing Twitter move by. He was, of course, a human being with faults, just like the rest of us, but he had a very, very strong sense of right and wrong. He was deeply loyal to those close to him. If I would make a mistake or do something would go wrong, we'd talk about it. He'd end the conversation by saying, onward and upward. That was sort of his motto. He would get upset about things, but he would always kind of move up, move on, and forget about it. He would say, learn from it, don't dwell on it, and you always knew that he was on your side. He took joy from the success of others, and he was always quick to help a close friend or colleague during tough times. During our Meet the Press tribute show that we did 2 days after he died, I remarked on the show that one of his favorite sayings was, the best exercise for the human heart was to bend down and pick someone else up. And he did that a lot. He did that with myself. He did that with Aaron. He did that with a lot of people close to him. And I know he would just be so happy to see the success of the show, and he'd be very happy that I was here speaking to you all. So I will stop here, and I will just be more than delighted to take any of your questions. Thank you.
I wondered if you'd comment on the relationship or effect of Tim Russert's working with Senator Monahan.
Oh, yeah. He did the best Moynihan impression ever. I can't even do it justice. But, and Tim will tell you the story, too, that he was a scrappy kid from Buffalo. And he worked his way in politics. And Senator Moynihan brought him into the Senate. And Tim, at the time, was very self-conscious that he had not gone to these Ivy League schools. He would go to the Senate and, hear people talking about all sorts of, philosophers and this and that. And he's a kid, from South Buffalo whose, parents, whose dad worked on a garbage truck and who, worked on the garbage truck himself during the summers to make money for college. And he'd sort of been on the streets of Buffalo. And Senator Moynihan said to him, you know more than these kids know. You have street smarts, and that's what I want. And so he was able to bring that to Senator Moynihan's staff and really became indispensable in the office. And, by the same token, Tim was really able to learn politics from the inside from the senator. And that never left him, and that helped him. I remember, as he made that transition into journalism, he was sometimes very sensitive about the fact that he had been in politics. Can you cross over that threshold from having an opinion working in politics into the news media? And sometimes I think he felt that the elitists of journalism would somehow look down their nose at him, and he was very sensitive to that. But what made him great was that he knew what was going on in the Capitol. He knew how these things evolved, and by having that wisdom, he was able to really hold politicians accountable and ask them the smart questions. So it was helpful to him very much.
Often I'm frustrated by politicians who don't answer the question that was asked, and also frustrated by what I perceive as a lack of persistence on the part of the interviewer. And I'm not just thinking of NBC. Sure. Occasionally I do watch other stations too. And in any event, what's the protocol on persistence in terms of trying to get an answer to a specific answer to a question that was posed?
Sure, that's a great question. I think what we try to do is, and again, these politicians will come on the program and they have a set of talking points that they want to deliver. And so what we think about trying to do during the course of an interview is to get them off of the talking points, sometimes more difficult than you would think. You know, you ask a question about, you know, what color is the sky? They want to talk about something else, and they'll just make up an answer that doesn't have anything to do with the question you just asked them, or they'll try to evade. And you know, frequently we'll say, David has a technique of saying, no, I'm sorry, Senator, the question I asked you was, and repeat that question again. Now, you do that once or twice, that's fine. You do it 3 or 4 or 5 times, you're obnoxious. So the viewer gets it, which is our whole point. And so I think what we're able to do is respectfully ask the question once or twice, and then if the person still is dodging, I think it's obvious to you, it's obvious to the viewers that there's something else there. We unfortunately can't give out truth serum before appearances on the show, unfortunately. At some point, you know, a guest that you really, really want this week may not be interested for whatever reason on coming on, but, you know, 2 years from then, they may have a book and they want to come on, and then you don't care. So these things have a way of sometimes coming into being and out. You know, we've been very lucky in terms of getting particular guests on. What's difficult, I will tell you, and that has really changed over the past 10 to 15 years, was this willingness of some guests to come on with other people to engage and have a debate and a conversation. When I first started the program, we used to have probably once or twice a month, I mean, just a ridiculous amount of time, we would have Senator Dole, Majority Leader of Senate, and the Minority Leader, George Mitchell, on the program together, and they would sit at the table, and, you know, we would ask them questions about what's going on. And I can tell you, these days, the concept of having the Majority Leader of the Senate and the Minority Leader of the Senate on together on a program does not happen, will not happen. So there's this increasing unwillingness and this increasing partisanship that is just permeates Congress right now, so that it's very difficult to sometimes get opposing sides on the program to have a substantive conversation on a Sunday morning. So that's probably the most frustrating part in terms of trying to get particular people on the program.
I teach journalism here at Creighton,
yeah.
And so and I have a lot of my students right here.
Great.
And I want to know if you're optimistic or pessimistic about journalism and its future. I personally am optimistic, but and the reason behind that, whatever side you're on.
Yeah, I am optimistic. I do feel like there are certain things that are healthy in an environment. Somebody was asking me earlier about, as I mentioned, kind of the Jon Stewart and the Stephen Colbert, and how a lot of students sort of get their news that way. And there's, you know, one school of thought that would, you'd look down their nose and say, oh, no, that's not real journalism. But I feel that even that is healthy in the sense that it is at least engaging young people in politics. It's getting them interested as they're way in the door. And maybe when they're old and stodgy, they'll be watching Meet the Press. but I do feel like what we are able to offer, you know, is this nonpartisan, down the middle, true journalism, and there's rooms for all of it. There is on cable what, you know, I like to think of as sort of the opinion page of the newspaper. But I do think that there's this tendency, which may be unhealthy, for people just to want to watch their own opinions regurgitated back to them every week. And so people that are conservative that just watch one news channel, or people that are liberal that just watch one, I feel like there needs to be more attention paid to kind of seeing both sides of an issue. I do feel this, you know, the Twitter world has its pros and its cons. I use Twitter a lot in terms of consuming news. I have lists of journalists that I trust on Twitter that I can look at and use as sort of my AP news feed, if you will, during the day to get a sense of interesting stories that are out there. But the key is knowing to trust a certain reporter or publication. There's a lot of things flying around on Twitter, but if you don't know where it came from, then you shouldn't trust it. You should develop, as a consumer of news, your own judgment on where you're getting true information from. Blogs, in that sense, there is no editor that is reading copy that's going into a blog. They can be interesting to spark conversation, or, I mean, I've gotten ideas for things before just from reading a blog, but I never will trust something without verifying where I got it from. So I do think the future is optimistic because I feel like as consumers, we have so many choices, and I think that's only good for the marketplace.
I'm wondering if you have an antidote for just plain news weariness.
Weariness, what do you mean?
Weariness. There, you talk about the proliferation of news both on line and TV, Twitter, Facebook, I don't know, you name it.
Yeah.
And you have a way, because you're skilled, sort of sorting out what's news and what isn't.
Right.
I feel within my circle of friends and people that people are genuinely just turned off because there's too much. It is impossible to digest it. Is that even something that you all talk about?
I do understand that, and I feel like a lot of people struggle with that. And you know, as I was talking about, you know, part of my job being sort of trying to distill some of that. I think just as a consumer, you have to sort of pick, you know, your places that you're looking at, that you don't feel like you need to read everything that's out there because that could just take forever. And just really to concentrate on those couple of sources that you really trust that can give you the news that you want, and the rest is kind of maybe noise, and just try to tune it out.
Betty, let me ask two questions. Mm-hmm. In all your years, who do you think was the most difficult guest to deal with? And secondly, do you have a favorite guest that has appeared during your time at Meet the Press?
Difficult, I will say. Let's see. Oh, I have one. one time we had the president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, on Meet the Press. And it was an interview with a lot of Secret Service around, as you can well imagine. He came to our studio, and the place was crawling with security. I was in the studio ahead of time with David Gregory, and we were getting ready for the interview, and I was going to go outside and meet the president, and the Secret Service said, no, you're not going anywhere. We'll bring him to you. And I said, okay. And so he came into the studio, and immediately the protocol people from the embassy just ripped into me that how dare I not be at the front door to greet the president. And how that was just an affront and insulting. And I tried to say, Secret Service, and they didn't want to hear that. They didn't want to hear me arguing with them. So I finally just said, I'm very sorry. So that was nothing like being chewed out by the chief protocol officer of a country to make your day not good. So that was probably the most difficult experience I've had with a guest. We don't have the sort of guests that are, I will only have green M&Ms in the green room, and we don't have a lot of the prima donnas. We do have, and one interesting thing that, you know, I've learned through the years is that you can tell a lot about a member of Congress or a senator by the way they treat their staff, and that's eye-opening sometimes. I've seen instances where, you know, a particular senator is very rude to his staff in front of other people. I've seen some unpleasant circumstances like that, and it's usually you can tell a lot about a person that way. Did you ask me about my favorite? That's hard, because anytime we can do anything that's fun and different, I enjoy. I remember we did an interview with Michael Jordan. We did an interview with Charles Barkley. Tim used to love to go to any kind of sporting event, especially if NBC Sports was carrying it, because then he'd have entree into the sporting event itself. And so we did a lot of fun shows of the basketball All-Star Game or the Super Bowl. Anytime we've had people on the program that, you know, we've had Jay Leno, we did an interview with Stephen Colbert, I started a web show to go along with Meet the Press about a year and a half ago called Press Pass that we do as a way to do some more conversational interviews, not the kind of hard-hitting Meet the Press interviews that we can do with interesting people involved in politics, but that are a different sort of speed. So we've done, just last week we had an interview with Harrison Ford. We've had George Clooney. This is tough, right? So we're able to do some fun and different interviews like that as well, which are fun for me in the sense that, you know, it's not just the same set of senators coming in. Those are the ones that sort of stand out to me. Yeah, sure. She was asking me how you sort of separate, and correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but how you separate your professional capacity to produce a program and to think about how you're going to do your job versus getting caught up in some of the emotional aspect of a tragedy or some sort of circumstance, and how do you separate those two things and work on doing the program. Do I have that summary right? Okay. That's a great question, and you know, I think you sort of go into news instinct. I think the most telling example that I've had to deal with that is just, you know, what hit home with me is when Tim died. That was a Friday, Friday the 13th, and I had a show to do on that Sunday, and I, you know, lost somebody that I worked with for 17 years. But I knew, and you know, with good help from people like Aaron and other people, I knew that I wanted to produce a show that Sunday that was meaningful and that was a way to celebrate Tim's life in a smart way. And so I had to sort of leave the personal part of that and focus for the next 48 hours on putting a program together. And I not only had to put the program together, but I was actually on the program. So I was sitting there on the television program that I was producing with a rundown on my lap, strangely enough, like worrying about when they were going to roll tape and then worrying about what I was going to say and how it was all going to come together. But I knew at the end of the day that I had a job to do, and I didn't want to turn that over to somebody else that wasn't invested in it like I was. So that's probably the biggest example of kind of trying to separate that personal process from professional. But a lot of times when these tragedies happen and we go into kind of strict production mode, for me anyway, on a Sunday morning after the show is over, I remember on several occasions sort of walking out of our NBC bureau, and for whatever reason, whatever tragedy it was, we have a flagpole in our driveway of the building, and you know, seeing the flag at half mast, walking out of the studio, and I remember sometimes sort of that weight coming off of my shoulder about a show, and then like finally taking that breath and being like, oh, what just happened, and then letting myself, like all of the rest of us do, sort of feel that emotion and the significance of something in more of a personal way.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Betsy Fisher Martin, senior executive producer of NBC's Meet the Press and managing editor for NBC News Political Programming. She spoke on the topic, Meeting the Press, Headlines in History from the Longest-Running Television Program. Mrs. Martin's remarks were given as the annual Alpha Sigma Nu lecture. Today's lecture is the 54th since 1955, sponsored by the Alpha Sigma Nu Alumni Club, and is the 13th lecture designated as the William F. Kelly S.J. Endowed Lecture. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 16, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.